Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and creator of People Stack Academy. My guest for this episode is Andrew Ramsden, founder of Alpha Transform. Welcome, Andrew.
G'day, Jen. Really excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, no problem. I'm really excited to chat with you as well. So let's get things started with the easy question, maybe the easiest question is, can you tell us a bit about Alpha Transform and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess at a really high level, I like to say that Alpha Transform provides culture, strategy, and leadership development to accelerate digital transformation and embed innovation as part of the business as usual of your organization. So I guess what that really means is organizations, large organizations, really struggle with innovation. They're built for safety. They're built for risk aversion. They're built to handle the BAU operations of a very successful business. And then what they tend to struggle with is dealing with the change that comes through innovation. And this has happened since time immemorial, innovation and change. And I guess what we're seeing today in this day and age is just a much sort of faster acceleration of the innovation that's required to keep up and stay relevant.
Right, right. And so when you say large organizations are built for safety, when you say large, what's your definition? What's your definition of a large organization?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess large organizations have thousands of staff and they're built with very specialist functions within them that do very specialist tasks. Mm-hmm. And they do those tasks really, really well. And that's how they've stayed in business. That's how they've been successful. That's how they've grown to the size that they are. Mm-hmm. And then it's about saying, well, you know what? We're going to see so many challenges coming down the pipeline in the next 5 to 10 years. We're going to see a huge skills gap in IT and digital skills. We're going to see a lot of other startups that are innovating and disrupting using digital technology. Mm-hmm. And these large organizations need to be able to reinvent themselves or at least parts of themselves and diversify or tackle the same problem through a new lens informed by the new technology that's available to be able to stay relevant and keep up.
Right. And in my experience, the larger organizations tend to be more resistant to change for exactly the reason that you were talking about, because they're built for safety. They've built, especially if it's an older, more established organization, right, where it's this is the way that we've been doing things. So how do you approach, I'm searching for the right word, I don't want to say like battle that resistance, because that almost feels like a little bit too harsh, but how do you approach that resistance given that what you do is trying to get them to think differently?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So I guess that's why for me, it's you have to take that holistic approach to get the best outcome for an organization. So that's starting from the top with that high level executive buy-in and then making sure you've got the right culture in the organization, which has a lot to do with the values or what the company values. Mm-hmm. And then how that's rolled out through the people in the organization in terms of the behaviors that are considered acceptable, the behaviors that are rewarded, the behaviors that are encouraged, and then taking it down to have a clear strategy that includes innovation. I mean, these days we talk about digital strategies, but really that's just a word that means innovation using the modern electronic and internet-connected technologies. And then I guess from there you want to make sure that the leaders within your organization are able to drive change and are able to connect between the technology and the business. And I guess that's where the focus of Alpha Transform is focused at the moment. And I know PeopleStack Academy has a similar charter to really focus in on technical professionals. Mm-hmm. Who are just fantastic problem solvers. They're fantastic thinkers. Mm-hmm. They're really good at making things happen and delivering. But in general, as a bit of a generalization, sometimes us geeks can struggle with the people side of the equation, the clarity of communication, mm-hmm. connecting through to the business strategy and influencing stakeholders in the business so that they actually come on board with the changes we know need to happen. So, yeah, when you look at it in those multiple layers, the buy-in, the culture, the strategy, the leadership, and assuming you've got the right capability underneath that, so the right digital skills, and then you put all of that together and you get an organization that's really ready to go forwards and tackle the challenges of transformation, so digital transformation.
Yeah, and that's so, it's refreshing to hear that, because you hear so much about resistance to change, as I was alluding to earlier, but if done right, if done carefully, if, like you said, if you get that, if you have that executive buy-in, if you sort of connect it with the values of the organization, that change really can happen, and some really awesome change can happen. But what are your thoughts on top-down versus bottom-up? So top-down, you know, sort of starting with the CEO or the higher-level executives and sort of getting that change to trickle down, versus, or maybe in addition to, more of a bottom-up approach where it's sort of starting at the managers or even lower than that. Sort of they're the ones who are really wanting this change and using that as a driver for change.
Yeah, great question. I think either is good, and I think it can start from either the bottom and go up or the top and come down. But I feel quite strongly that it's not until both come together that it really starts to work and work well at scale for an organization. And I think I would encourage people who are at that leadership level, that management level within the business, to really take up the role of digital champion and push your organization along if they're not there yet. And to me, that's just about trying to get some quick runs on the board. Mm-hmm. And a lot of forward-thinking CEOs and company executives are quite open to leaders within their organization taking the initiative, mm-hmm. squirreling a little bit of time away to run some experiments, and then coming back to them to demonstrate a business case for why we should invest more money in a new idea or a new innovation or a new way of working or a new way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's a good way to scale their risk as that idea grows, is start small. It's a very agile and lean way of thinking, yep. I guess. Start small, run some experiments, and that's the best way to prove the value of what it is that you're talking about. Oftentimes, stakeholders struggle to really understand what you're talking about until they can see it, mm-hmm. and touch it and interact with it. So even a prototype is a great start, and then make that business case. And get a bit of a groundswell of collaborators on your side. So go and talk to others who are passionate at that grassroots level within your organization, and get them behind what you're doing, and then take that upwards. So yeah, that's absolutely a way to do it, no doubt.
Yeah, that's really great advice about, you know, sort of thinking about it in terms of running experiments or building a prototype, and then using that to convince people slightly higher up that, hey, look, we built this thing, or this, either this real thing or this virtual thing, and it actually does work. Experiments or skunk works projects, as they're sometimes called, that right. It doesn't necessarily have to be like so on the down low, or don't tell anybody about this, that it could be just a matter of thinking about it as an experiment, that's totally legitimate, and it doesn't have to feel, you know, dirty or like you're hiding it from someone. I advise my clients to do these kinds of things all the time, and some of them are like, oh, but what's going to happen? What if someone found out? I'm like, well, that's the point, right? You don't have to be, you know, running in the back door, you know, finding a secret entrance or whatever. But I like the way that you described it, that's a nice way of sort of bringing it all together, so that you have it from the top down, from the bottom up, and everywhere in between.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So you've referred to digital transformation, digital strategies a couple of times. So I want to make sure that we, as we're kind of dancing around that phrasing, that we really are clear about what we're talking about with that. So what do you mean? What comes to mind? What is your definition of digital transformation? And can you give us some specific examples?
Yeah, for sure. So I guess digital transformation is just a buzzword, really. it's a pretty popular one these days, but it can be quite confusing. So I guess the word digital obviously relates to technology, and originally the definition of digital was very much about technology, and specifically that sort of electronic and computer technology and internet-connected technology. Mm-hmm. But I'd say that more and more over time, we've seen that the business, more and more of the business becomes about technology. So these days, every business is a digital business. There'd be very, very few businesses that don't rely on technology or couldn't be vastly improved in terms of efficiency and innovation through the use of technology. So to successfully embrace the benefits of technology at the core of the business, there sort of came this collective understanding of this idea that the technology is the easy part and the hard part is really the people. So it seems that digital transformation and digital has become about far more than the technology. And I guess this is where companies are struggling. They have silos between the IT people and the marketing people and the CEO or the CFO. So I guess I like to define digital transformation as a bit about being closing that gap between the technology, the customer, and the business. And in terms of examples, I guess Kodak is always the example that springs to mind of a company that hasn't or didn't take the opportunities that it had to move with the times and to really lean into and embrace digital technology. They actually invented the first prototype digital camera. Mm-hmm. I think the engineer's name was Steve Sasson, and he took it to his supervisors and they told him, initially they told him, you know, you keep working on it, but we don't think much is going to come from it and we're not going to give you any more resources. Mm. And when he brought back a functional production model to them, they said, well, we're actually, the executives canned the idea and said, we're not going to promote this or sell it because it's going to erode our existing analog film business lines. And unfortunately, in 2012, they had to file for bankruptcy because they couldn't keep up. Everybody else jumped on board with digital and it did erode their business, but they could have eroded themselves. They could have disrupted themselves. So that's really where they could have taken a digital transformation approach and transformed themselves to avoid that.
Right. So I think I hear what you're saying is that the transformation isn't just about the technology or the digitalness. It's also about the people as well. To have one, you have to have the other.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I guess primarily thanks to Steve Jobs and Apple, that understanding that the focus needed to be on the customer, and that's what it took to really excel in business. So that's kind of the third part of the equation is the business and the people and the technology and the customer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And the idea of focusing on the customer, focusing on the user. What can we do to user experience, right? The whole idea behind user experience design is let's put ourselves in that person's shoes and look at it from that perspective as opposed to some other perspective. That's a really good point. That's a very people-oriented kind of focus, the customer-oriented kind of the value, the customer orientation value that so many businesses have.
Very true.
Yeah. All right. So let's shift the conversation a little bit. I would like to hear, and I'm sure my listeners as well would like to hear about your story.
Sure thing. Happy to. It's a bit of a saga, but here we go. I mean, there's always bumps and definitely some of the larger bumps for me came in high school. And I guess I was a typical nerd. I was heavily into music and science fiction and computer games. I was possibly somewhere on the ASD spectrum. I've never been tested, but, you know, there have been the clues. And I think, funnily enough, I've always wanted to be a leader since I was very young. And it just, I don't know why, I can't really explain that, but I always felt like I had good ideas and I wanted to share them. And that I wanted others to then follow my lead. But I guess when I was in school, I had no clue what that actually meant. Mm-hmm. And I was very, very logical and very direct with people. And as you can imagine, that got me into a lot of trouble with the other students. Mm-hmm. I guess I would tell people what I thought without sugarcoating it or caring about how that might make them feel. And I very quickly became an outcast. I was regularly picked on and bullied. And sometimes that was violently. And I guess it got to the point where I decided, and I guess my parents helped in that decision as well. They were a part of that decision to pick me up and move me between schools to see if the school itself was the problem. Mm-hmm. And I guess the new kids were really friendly at the new school, but funnily enough, I repeated the same behavior and became an outcast again. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was up and I was in denial up until that point. And it was at that point that I really realized the common denominator here was me. And only I could do something to change that. So I made a decision at that point. I was about 16, to really change the way I interacted with people quite dramatically, and just make the assumption that I know nothing about how to do it, and run little experiments to try to discover what worked and what didn't work, which sounds like a very over-analytical way to do it. And I guess I didn't realize it at the time, but I was essentially teaching myself emotional intelligence and how to interact with and influence people. And my problem was that I had terrible EQ, I had terrible emotional intelligence, and I was learning to improve that. So I guess my focus was to try to discover what do I need to do or say, and how would I say it to get the best out of each situation. Mm-hmm. And that was quite a departure from that very logical, very black and white thinking. I guess the conclusion I kept coming to was a really important lesson for me, which was, don't focus on what's right or wrong or what's technically correct. It's more important to focus on what's most useful now and in the moment and going forwards. And I guess that meant that if I had to let people think they were right and I was stupid, that was fine. And it wasn't always most important to make sure they knew I was correct. And yeah. if that meant I had to let people think they came up with an idea that I seeded, then so be it. Mm-hmm. They would champion that idea for me. So it all sort of worked out. And I guess it's a mantra I've been able to apply over and over again through different areas of my life. And I still see it as a really core foundational mindset for good EQ and great leadership. So that was sort of my high school experience, I guess, and some of the bumps there. And I went on to study music composition at university, funnily enough. And I really enjoyed that. I'm a creative sort, and that was certainly part of my background up until that point. But I figured I'd find it hard to make a living. And I'd also really, really become interested in electronic composition and building web pages. And I realized that I enjoyed working with the computers as much as I did the music itself. Mm-hmm. So I made a transition at that point to go and study IT.
Yep.
And funnily enough, although some of the IT subjects were really, really tough, the biggest bump in studying IT was, as you can imagine, the people.
Okay. Yep. Yep.
And I remember a particular project. It was from a project management and development course, and there was a group assignment, and it just went horribly wrong. Mm-hmm. We were working together to develop this web application in Java, and we ended up with a week-long crunch to get it all finished. And there wasn't a lot of sleep involved. It was pretty brutal. Mm-hmm. And I remember I'd pulled together a CVS revision control system, but I couldn't get everyone using it. And so CVS, I guess, is like today's SVN or today's Git. But it wasn't an amazing revision control system, but it was the best that we had. To be honest, it was pretty fantastic. It had some issues around merge conflicts.
Okay.
But best available at the time. And I remember staying up all night when the others went home to manually merge just hundreds of files from the four developers and just thousands of lines of code. Huh. And eventually I had that done in the morning, and it was all working, and I checked it all into the repo. Mm-hmm. And I emailed everyone at 9 a.m. to say, look, this is where the latest code is. And then I went home to sleep, and I came back in the afternoon to find they'd forgotten to check their email completely. Huh? they'd worked all day on their own unique copies of the code base. And there were about 2 days left, and I was just furious, and I couldn't help but just blow up. And I was exhausted from working around the clock. And for nothing, I guess. It was a complete waste of time.
Hmm.
But I guess, as you can imagine, it didn't really help blowing up at them.
Right.
They didn't care. They were also tired, and you know, they got upset with me as a result. And I guess I learned here that same lesson that I've heard many times from other technical professionals that I've talked to. I think this was something you've said yourself, Jen, when we last caught up around leadership and technology, was that the technology is the easy part and the hard parts are the people.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, again, it was about focusing on who was right and who was wrong, just wasn't useful at all. And we had to move forward in the most pragmatic way that we could.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized at that point I probably still had a lot to learn about influencing and leading people, but it was it was one of those really
learning.
Really tough
a learning
learning
moment.
Yeah. Absolutely.
How did the project end up? Was this a class project? Did it end up being turned in and you got a decent grade on it? You passed?
It did, surprisingly enough. I think I ended up coming back that night after I got over myself and merging the code again manually and checking it all in and saying, I told them in advance that's what I'd do and I'd have it all checked in and you know, it got easier from there. But we did manage to, I can't remember exactly what the grade was that we got.
That's probably the most important detail from this. You know, it's that, you know, it was a nice learning experience for you and that perhaps it wasn't a complete waste. Perhaps you did learn something from it. And it sounds like you really did.
Oh, absolutely. I guess that's the beauty of university, isn't it? It's the beauty of group projects.
Yes. Yes. And as a former professor who would give group projects quite a bit, and my students would be like, and then at the end of the semester, there'd be the groups who didn't get along very well, but there were the groups that just really clicked and it was awesome. So yes, yes. I've been on both sides of that. I can relate to both sides of the group project stories.
Yep. Yep. Oh, look, and I wouldn't change a thing. In hindsight, I just think it was a wonderful opportunity and I really enjoyed the study that I did in IT and the people and the situations. Mm-hmm. But I guess hindsight's great like that. You have these rose-colored glasses, but sure. I definitely remember the pain at the time.
Yeah, yeah. So you studied IT and then at some point you became a web developer. Was that your first job after university?
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I was working in small web startups and again, another great opportunity, great experience, because when you're in a small company, you have to do a little bit of everything. So there was some sys administration and some back end and front end development in web, some design and even some client liaison and leading small teams and just great variety and great creativity and pace. I love that environment, but I guess it was still a bit limiting. I felt like I wanted to make a bigger impact, a bigger positive impact on the world. And I felt I couldn't do that in that situation. So I ended up in government after that. I ended up in Queensland government. And I guess that's probably another bump for anyone who's worked in government. Government gives you this great sense of purpose.
Yep.
And you know that you're helping people directly or indirectly, but you know, you don't go and work for government unless you're okay with bumps.
That's a great poll quote. Yeah. That's good. Yep.
And I guess I started off in developer roles in government and I was fairly experienced at this point, but more than anything else, I really prided myself on being a good problem solver, as I think a lot of us technical folk do. Mm-hmm. And I was really respected for that, my technical role, but I found that if I applied that sort of problem solving, that sort of thinking outside of that domain, I wasn't really listened to. I wasn't taken seriously. I was just expected to stay in my little technical box. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is where I realized I wasn't as good at influencing others as I thought. And I realized there's more to influence than just good EQ. And it prompted this realization that I needed to keep improving my skills and just have a real commitment to lifelong learning. Mm. And I think that's been an important part of certainly my journey. And I think it's an important part of lots of other leaders' journeys is that idea that it's not enough to learn and then stop. Mm-hmm. And look, I really enjoy learning. So it's been good for me. And I guess you get to certain points where you think, oh, I've learned enough. Surely I'm made from this point onwards. And I just had to keep reminding myself, no, that's not useful. You actually have to remember that you do enjoy learning. Sure, it takes effort, but sure. When you get into it, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And so was this desire to learn more and to push yourself to learn a little bit more, is that part of what prompted you to start your own business?
Oh, look, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's for me, working in government, I've had amazing opportunities to learn a lot about change management and digital transformation and digital strategy and how to lead people and how to influence people and form high-performing partnerships. But there's a real gap in my skill set around that commercial space, that commercial nous. So for anyone who hasn't worked in government, what you'll tend to do is bid for some money to do a project or to run your team. Uh-huh. And that becomes, if successful, that becomes your budget for the year. And then really you're tracking your finances against, you're tracking your spend against that budget to make sure you come in on budget. Or if you can find clever ways to save money, you can then return money back to the central coffers so that it gets redistributed to where it's needed. But you're not usually concerned about revenue coming in and cash flow and am I going to have enough money to keep this all afloat and when do we scale up and scale down?
Yep.
That just doesn't factor into it. It's very, very hard to make the case to scale things up in government, even if they're going great guns, unless you put a more commercialized business model in place. So it's, to me, I identified that as a real gap and something that I'd like to expose myself to is some more experience in that commercial space and that commercial way of thinking.
Yeah, and what you said about government as far as the way that budgeting is done, and there's you have a budget and it's a fixed budget, but there's no focus on revenue coming in. That very much describes the academic world as well. That's where I was in my former life. And I never thought of it that way. You know, that there's, and I'm sure you can relate to this, you know, sort of moving from government to having your own business, lots of differences. And some of them are subtle shifts, some of them are not so subtle. But I think one of the things that I haven't picked up on that you just mentioned was about this, there's no focus on the revenue coming in. There's no focus on marketing. There's no focus on sales, or at least very little. And so it's almost like, at least in academia anyway, like an anti-marketing culture where, you know, if you market, it's almost like it's a bad thing or evil. No, you're not supposed to be promoting yourself, versus when you have your own business, you absolutely need to do that. And that I could totally, I'm totally with you on that in terms of learning how to fill in that skill gap. That sounds very, very, very similar in our journeys.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd love to pick your brain some more about that at another time. And I guess to be fair, the other reason that I really wanted to go out there and start a business is I got a sense that it might be, again, another way that I could actually have a bigger positive impact. So we'll see how that plays out. But inside of government, you always run into certain limitations and it's hard to scale certain ideas and get traction for them from within a 9-to-5 role where you've got a full plate and a full workload. So we'll see how this plays out, but I can already see ways that through leadership development or culture development and strategy development with organizations, including government, because I'm absolutely committed to trying to help government improve what it does, stay relevant, and make the world a better place, essentially. I mean, it sounds cheesy, but I believe government and small business in particular can play a really strong part in making the world a better place.
Absolutely. Totally with you on that. Yeah. Yeah. Hey there, folks. We'll get back to the interview in two shakes of a lamb's tail. But first, are you a tech manager? Is leading your team like herding cats? Are you sick of making stuff up without trusted systems to guide you? Are your days filled with useless, time-sucking meetings? Join my Facebook group with other tech geeks who are coming together to build thriving, high-performing teams who don't need constant handholding. No HR BS, just real stories from real geeks who understand the nuances of being a techie. To join us, go to genbunk.com/Facebook. Without further ado, please enjoy the remainder of the interview. So I heard you're writing a book. So
right.
I'd love to hear about that. So I do want to hear about what the content of what it is that you plan on writing about. But I'd also like to chat a bit about the process as well, if you're okay with that.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. So the book is about being a leader in a technical field. So it's very much focused in on that initial space that I'm looking to explore with the business as well. And I explore through the podcast that I'm running, the Alpha Geek podcast. Mm-hmm. And I believe this is a something of an underrepresented space, and I'm really glad to have seen what you've been able to do with the PeopleStack podcast and the PeopleStack Academy. And I believe that it's just such an important space. There needs to be more happening in that area. And I'd say that's because we're going to see a really large skills gap in the next 5-10 years. So I guess I talked about that earlier, but it's great news for us in the industry. We'll be in demand. And the other thing that we'll probably see is that a lot of the capability will be outsourced because there just won't be enough skilled workers to do the work. Mm-hmm. And I feel that companies can do that. They can outsource, but they're going to need to retain really strong digital and IT leaders to lead those remote teams mm-hmm. and to lead those projects and ensure that that close alignment between the business and the technology and where that's going. So I would say that if you've ever thought about getting into leadership or management, to for the listeners out there, now's a great time to do it because mm-hmm. it's also really quite rewarding for anyone who wants to increase their influence, their impact, and or their income.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the gap that I'm looking to fill in terms of that book. There are a couple of books out there about technical leadership, and I think they're fantastic. I can send you some links for the show notes mm-hmm. about some of the ones I've been researching in particular. But I'm really looking to focus in on the people side in particular and dealing with influencing people mm-hmm. and very much trying to target the, as a generalization, the gaps that I've seen in my own journey and then in talking to other technical leaders and about their journeys and their staff. So the people that report to them, the gaps that they're seeing in technical professionals throughout organizations. So okay. That's sort of the angle I'm taking. Been doing a lot of research for the book. I've been speaking with, as I say, tech leaders and CIOs and CTOs and entrepreneurs and managers and yeah. even hands-on tech influencers and yeah. really learning about the challenges that they're facing and the successes they've had. And I've just thoroughly enjoyed that. It's been fantastic to have those conversations. And as I say, with their permission, I've been able to record those and release many of them through the podcast. Mm-hmm. So that's the alphageekpodcast.com mm-hmm. as a bit of a plug for anyone who's keen to go and get another dose of excellent leadership and technology podcasting.
Excellent. Yes.
And I guess I've been able to find some patterns and trends, find those gaps.
Yep.
And I've combined that with my own thinking and experience. And there's really 6 key themes that have emerged out of that. And I'm calling those the 6 superpowers of great technical leaders. First one is called simulation. It's about reflection and visualization. It's really about how advancing and improving, how quickly you learn and grow and improve. Mm-hmm. The second one's cognition, which is about how much your decisions are impacted by biases and emotion and fatigue and how to overcome that. There's intention, which is about how credible and trustworthy do people find you. And yeah. there's inspiration, which is about yeah. how well you motivate others and sustain that energy over time. And there's also conversation, which is about how clear and compelling your communication is. And finally, the last one is persuasion, which is about how well you can bring others on the journey with you. Yeah. So those 6 seem to form a powerful package that the tech leaders that I've found that have 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 of those seem to be really having a huge impact yeah. inside of their careers, and their careers have really taken off as a result.
That's awesome. I love that. Simulation, cognition, intention, inspiration, conversation, and persuasion. The 6 superpowers of great tech leaders. That's absolutely on point with my experience as well. So it sounds like you're in the research stage right now. Have you started the writing, or is it more just about kind of gathering thoughts at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. The writing has begun. Mm-hmm. it's turning out to be a bigger job than I thought it would be. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm probably about 40,000 words in. And I feel like I've scratched the surface, you know, and I probably need to look at reining in the scope of this first book, maybe turning it into a two book series.
Yeah.
Or maybe I just understand and accept that this is my process, that I need to get it all out, get it all down.
Got it.
And then go back through and cull.
And cut and cull, right. So is 40,000, like how many like double space pages? Just to give us a sense of like that's, it's a lot, right?
Oh, wow. Yeah, it is. It feels like a lot.
Do you count that way? Or?
No, I feel like I should Google right now 40,000 words in pages. How many pages in 40,000 words? Apparently, it's 80 pages single spaced or 160 double spaced.
Got it.
I guess if I'm having a really good day, I could probably churn out about 4,000 words. I'm not the fastest writer in the world, but I find that probably 1,000 or 2,000 words a day is more sustainable. But I really need my peak time to be doing that. You know, I need that that open session in the morning for a few hours just after having some exercise or having a little bit of caffeine. And I need all the other distractions to melt away, because it's very easy to procrastinate when you're trying to write.
Absolutely. And that was going to be one of my first questions is, do you have a specific time that you write? And it sounds like you absolutely do.
Yeah, I really had to find a particular groove to get most of my writing done. And to be honest, at the moment, because I'm focusing on building the business, it's taken a little bit of a backseat. I'm still doing more research, and it just looks like the launch might have to be delayed by a couple of months.
That's super exciting with the book. Do you have any other like sort of habits or processes that you followed to create an atmosphere that where you can do the best writing you possibly can?
Yeah, great question. I find that having some physical exercise in the morning. So for me, being the typical geek that I was, exercise was not a priority for me for most of my life. And it's something that I've found to be really, really valuable, but only in the last couple of years. And I had to really make that a priority. And once I found a form of exercise that worked for me and I really enjoyed it, it was no longer a chore. It became a priority. It became a love. It became a passion. So for me, that was rock climbing. Very lucky to have a climbing gym that's got just bouldering walls. Bouldering is just climbing without a rope, but the walls aren't as high, so it's not as dangerous. And there's crash mats, so it's all fairly safe. So I can get in there before I start my day and do what is just a fantastic workout. It's sort of lots of resistance and lots of whole body workout. You've got to use your core to stabilize yourself and your arms and legs to climb. And I really work up a sweat. And that just, I feel so energized as a result of that. So doing that and some deep breathing. So the two in combination, some exercise, some breathing, and then I'm very much more in the headspace. So it's not not really meditation. And I really need to spend more time meditating, because that can be really powerful as well. But just the exercise plus the breathing is usually enough to get me in a really nice zone.
Yeah, that's great. And I could totally relate to what you're talking about when it comes to having some sort of physical exercise. I recently myself have started, I did yoga on and off for a while, but I've started doing weight training recently in the past. What has it been? It's like a few months now, I want to say. It may be longer. But it's just what you said about it doesn't feel like the beginning. It kind of feels like a chore, like because it's different and it's a change of your schedule and I got to go do this. But it gets to the point, and it's gotten to the point for me that it's like you want to. If you miss a day, you totally feel the negative effects, right? Like, how did I live without doing this? If you're
absolutely
sick or whatever, I didn't go to the gym this Monday because I wasn't feeling well. I usually go twice a week, and then on Thursday I like just absolutely had to go, because I was like it affects you mentally. That sort of mental physical back and forth is just inescapable. So
Just the endorphins alone that come as a result of a good session is it's so energizing for the day.
Yeah, that's a great point. Cool. All right, so the last question that I have for you is something that I ask all of my guests, and that is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
So yeah, people can be painful.
Yeah, here.
Yeah. And I guess I like to think of it that 99% of the time they actually mean really well, even when they're painful. Mm-hmm. So I've learned to give people a lot of room to be people, because they see the world differently to the way I do. They have different priorities. They have their own goals and agendas and pressures. They have their good days and bad days. They have their own emotions and families and personal issues, etc. So you have to give them the benefit of the doubt. And I think more often than not, their intentions are actually really good. They just express themselves really poorly.
Yeah.
And that's where the pain comes from.
Yeah.
So I think usually if you assume they have good intentions and you can ask clarifying questions and really take an interest in what's going on for them and their goals, you can forge a good relationship with, I guess, just about anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Just about anyone.
Yes.
And even that takes a lot of patience, and you have to swallow your pride again, and you focus on not correcting them. So you're not focusing on what's correct. You're focusing on what's useful and what it's going to take that relationship forwards. And I guess I've talked about that principle a fair bit already.
Mm-hmm. I think it bears repeating, though. I really do like the idea of it's not about what's correct. It's about what's useful. I think that in the tech world, especially I've experienced this with folks who are software developers in particular, because they just happen to be in my social circles. It's who we hang around with, who my husband and I hang around with, that because their lives are so focused on the minutiae of, say, writing code, that it has to be correct, right? And not that there's a correct or that there's different ways to write a program, right? But there's very detail-oriented is the word that I was searching for. And so when your life is so detail-oriented, you get so focused on being correct, or at least close to correct, as opposed to being useful. And I think that's an important shift for people to think about, not just software developers, for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's such a tough shift as well. And I still catch myself having to just bite my tongue and swallow my pride in lots of interactions. And I think... I guess your question was really about the challenge, and it kind of sounds like I have all the answers already, but I don't. And you know, there are some people that continue to test that assumption that they have good intentions, and these are the people that I feel like I've given them opportunity after opportunity to interact really civilly and work constructively together as adults, and yet they keep taking the opportunities to act in ways that make me feel that their only intention, I guess, is to win.
Right.
And it's those really selfish intentions that become a real problem for me. And I find it very, very hard to keep biting my tongue and to keep sort of playing, keep rising above and playing that civil, respectful adult way. You start to get drawn into the way that they're operating. And more often than not, I feel like that just sort of gives them the power.
Yeah.
And I guess... I should give some specific examples. So I've had people who look for any opportunity to escalate an issue with what I'm doing over my head without consulting me first.
Mm.
And that'll really tick me off, especially if they're doing that repeatedly.
Sure.
Abrupt communication, no pleases and thank yous, no acknowledgement of questions or communication, just plain rudeness. People who aren't willing to have an adult-to-adult conversation about an issue, and they just stand on hierarchy or arbitrary decisions. So, for example, if you said to a staff member, no, look, you can't switch your days off this week, without a reason for saying no, and shutting down any conversation with that staff member about why, and saying, look, I'm the manager, it's not open for discussion. If I say it, that's final. Then, you know, it's those sorts of things that feel arbitrary, and they feel like selfish intentions. They feel like that person just needs to win, or just needs to have control, or stamp their authority. And it doesn't take the other person's intentions or need into account. And that, for me, gets really infuriating.
Mm-hmm.
And look, there have been a few of those over the years where I've found it very, very difficult to pull it back to an adult-to-adult type relationship.
Yep.
And most people I try a few different approaches with, and I find that if I'm generous and open to hearing what's going on for them, they come around and we work really well together.
Yep.
Even if that relationship was really prickly at first.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's cool about that is those really difficult and prickly people often become your strongest champions, because they're really tough people. But once you've got them on board, they take that really strong personality and they engage with others on your behalf.
Yes.
I think is really cool.
Yeah. And so, I think what you said about, you know, sort of just, you know, about being generous and being as generous as you possibly can, that that can be the turning point. Very often I've been thinking a lot lately around, you know, serving and the idea of serving people and just having that be the main mission, that everything else is secondary. I want to help. I want to do everything that I can. But what that means is that we need to make sure that if we're going to serve and going to help, we need to make sure our proverbial buckets are full or even overflowing, because there are going to be those people who are just out there to win, who are just out there to drain your bucket.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. We are just about up on time. I want to thank you very much, Andrew, for sharing your stories. It's a story that I think a lot of folks, including myself, can relate to. So thank you for sharing. Thank you for being vulnerable. Thank you for offering your thoughts and your wisdom. It was an absolute pleasure talking with you.
Oh, thank you, Jen. I've really enjoyed it, and always enjoy talking to you. So anytime.
All right. Thanks very much.